The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
I am your host, Soraya, and welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Tonight's interview was actually pre-recorded a couple of weeks ago with Wallace Thornhill. And Wallace is best known probably from his work on Thunderbolts and the Electric Universe theory. And I'll be very honest, I love this interview. I love Wallace's work. I think it's utterly fascinating. And well, hopefully you'll see why as this interview goes on. Also, just a reminder, you can check us out not only on YouTube and iTunes, but we're on Stitcher, we're on Deprogrammed Radio, we're on Dark Matter Radio. All this stuff is linked up at wheredidtheroadgo.com. And also, if you like the show and you want to help support us, give us a donation or consider giving us a few bucks for a donation. It helps us pay server fees, and we got some stuff planned, and it's going to take a little bit of money and traveling to make it all happen, but it should be very interesting, and I intend on keeping everything on Where Did the Road Go free, so donations help. They really do. And beyond that, well, here is the interview with Wallace Thornhill. And it's my honor tonight to have with us Wallace Thornhill, and you're coming at us live from Australia, aren't you?
That's right.
And you are, well, honestly, your work completely changed the way I look at the universe. Your work with the Electric Universe, it was just, as soon as I came across it, it was just so astounding and so mind-boggling. And it, partially in its simplicity, it was just so obvious once you know what to look for.
That's the basis on which I work.
Do you want to tell people a little bit about where the initial theory of the Electric Universe came from?
Well, there have been headlines in the paper some decades ago when Hans Alfvén was working on plasma cosmology, and it was then called the Electric Universe. And also another pioneer in plasma science, and I'll talk about that in a minute, Winston Bostick also was producing galaxies in his electric discharge experiments. So it does have a long history. Also, going back more than a century, in Norway, Christian Birkeland was reproducing the aurora and rings and sunspot activity on globes, magnetized globes inside a discharge chamber. So the ideas behind it have been around for a long while. But for me, it was a process of discovery, working from an initial idea that was presented to me before I got to university, which suggested that the solar system that we see today is not the one that our ancient forebears and our prehistoric ancestors witnessed. And that, for me, was a huge challenge because, of course, the immediate answer to that was that it disobeys Newton's law of gravity and Newton's dynamics. And so this was a huge hurdle to face. But out of it all came a synthesis, which has finally produced what you might call a big picture, a new cosmology, has only been in place for the last decade or so.
All right. And what role did Velikovsky have in all of this?
Well, Velikovsky was the one who provided the impossible idea that Venus was a comet in the memory of mankind. And I read that while I was at high school, and I was the only science undergraduate who spent a lot of time in the sociology shelves at the library reading myths and legends of various ancient races right around the world. And in doing so, I found that he had made a case to answer. I mean, you can argue with the details of what he said and also bring it down into historical times, which I think created a huge hurdle for him, which may have been unnecessary. But the basic thesis I found, he had provided solid evidence for it, and it was probably the most critical thing that had to be answered. If Venus was a comet within the memory of man, how did it achieve the most circular orbit of any planet in the solar system in a matter of a few thousand years? This meant that Newton's law of gravity is not the only thing that's acting, and this was the challenge that Velikovsky threw down to astronomers, and they just ignored it on the basis that it disobeyed Newton's laws. But he was saying, no, you have to look at Newton's laws, because the ancients also said there were colossal thunderbolts exchanged between planets when they come close to one another, and this obviously plays a part in the mechanism. But that was too much back in the 1950s, and it's still too much, I think, because you won't find any mention of electricity in any textbook on astrophysics or astronomy.
Which just seems absolutely bizarre to me. You would think even if they didn't believe in the electric universe theory, they would still include that to some level in astrophysics and such.
Yes, we have on record one classic comment by a leader in astrophysics who said, we know there's electricity out there, but it doesn't do anything. And yet here we're talking about a force which is 10 to the 39th power times stronger than gravity. So even a tiny amount of electricity acting in space will swamp any gravitational effects.
Now, obviously there are mathematical formulas for gravity and stuff, but scientists don't technically know what gravity is, do they?
That's true. Newton had the sense to say that he didn't know how gravity worked, just that his equation worked. And to think that Einstein answered the question is a mistake, because all he did was to use a form of hyperdimensional geometry to try and explain, to try and actually describe, not explain, what the effects of gravity are. But when you look at Newton's law, the thing that stands out when you look at it closely is that there is no mention of time. Time doesn't play any part, which means that gravity operates instantly. And this is something which, of course, in modern physics is totally anathema. It's not allowed, because Einstein said information cannot be transmitted faster than the speed of light. Well, the sun knows where the Earth is right now, and the Earth knows where the sun is right now. And it's very simple to show that that's the case, because if it weren't so, you would have an effect. The force between the sun and the Earth would not be pointing directly at the sun. It would be slightly offset. And it would have the same effect as you swinging a weight around your head on the end of a piece of string. If it weren't for the string, the object would fly off. Well, there's nothing holding the Earth to the sun except for the force of gravity. And if this force was acting not directly towards where the sun is right now, but where it appears in the sky, there would be a force which would sling all of the planets out of the solar system in a very short space of time, measured in maybe tens of thousands of years, not in millions or billions of years, which is supposed to be the the age of the solar system. Of course, what Velikovsky's breakthrough meant is that the entire history of the solar system, the Earth and the human race, is not what we think it is. What we're being taught is a kind of a fairy tale, a myth.
All right. What would you say the biggest problems with the standard model in science is?
Well, there are many. The biggest problem when you talk about the stars and the planets and so on is that the present cosmology relies on the quantum theory at the subatomic level and on Einstein's general theory of relativity and gravity at the largest level. Now, gravity is supposed to control the orbiting of stars and galaxies, the planets around the stars and so on. But at the quantum level, you're talking about activity that goes on inside the atom and which no one understands. I mean, the top scientists, quantum physicists, say nobody really understands the basis of quantum theory, because you have spooky effects. So you've got these two incompatible theories. The two don't work together. So the answer, I mean, the physicists have been looking for quantum gravity now to try and draw the two together. But all of this is just a form of mathematical gamesmanship. the Electric Universe actually follows the lead of the 18th and 19th century scientists who were trying to simplify things. But today we have a Nobel Prize which encourages people to invent new forces, new particles. So you have dark matter and dark energy and all sorts of nonsense, which is a purely mathematical endeavor and has no real explanation in terms of the physics or classical physics. And that is the big problem which the Electric Universe addresses.
And I had read somewhere that there are seven unproven theories that need to be in place in order for the Big Bang theory to actually work. Is that accurate?
Well, I would say that the Big Bang theory is not even a theory. It's just a story. It's a version of the creation myth that the Christian religions and so on are based on, you know. In the beginning, there was a miracle. There was let there be light, and everything was sort of created out of nothing. It's the same with the Big Bang. No physicist knows what matter is or how you create it. So to say that the Big Bang created all of the matter out of energy is pure nonsense, because nobody knows how you do that. It's a miracle, and it's no less a miracle than the biblical one.
Okay, what does the Electric Universe say about the beginning of our existence, of our universe?
Well, the fact is that the astronomer Halton Arp, who died last December, unfortunately, has been named by some top astronomers like Sir Fred Hoyle and the Burbages, Geoffrey and Margaret, and others as the modern Galileo. Because his work on peculiar galaxies and an atlas of peculiar galaxies showed him that quasars, which are these objects which are supposed to be highly redshifted and at the ends of the universe, were actually nearby and were being ejected from the centers of active galaxies. Now, the reason I'm telling you this is because the whole idea of the Big Bang sprang from the idea that redshift indicated the speed with which something is moving away from us. But Halton Arp was able to show that the redshift, most of it, was due to the youthfulness of a body. So all these things which are supposed to be at the ends of the universe are actually nearby and part of a family structure of galaxies giving birth to companion galaxies and so on, which is a completely different picture. There is no expansion of the universe that he could discern. But his work was ignored, and then when somebody tried to discredit it, they used statistical techniques, which was typically designed to fail. So his work has not been seriously addressed. But that paints a completely different picture of cosmology and the origin of the universe, the origin of the matter in galaxies and so on. And the Electric Universe fits with it perfectly. So I would suggest that the first step for cosmologists is to look at what Edwin Hubble actually said. He felt that the expansion of the universe was the least likely option for his discovery. But nobody teaches you that anymore.
And so the Electric Universe doesn't postulate a beginning necessarily.
No, all we say is that we're ignorant of how matter is formed. We're ignorant of the extent of the universe, its age, and its origin. And I think this is a perfectly reasonable place to be in the 21st century. You know, why should we think that in the last few microseconds of our existence on this planet that we've suddenly got all the answers? You know, it really is an incredible arrogance on our part to even suggest such a thing.
Now, just recently you posted a video about the, and I forgot what it is, the background, the proof of the Big Bang that they came up with.
Oh, yes, the cosmic microwave background.
Yes.
That, of course, was based on a pure assumption, and the initial estimates of the temperature of this radiation by those who subscribe to the Big Bang theory was way out. You know, it was actually, there were much closer estimates by those people just using a classical approach, you know, the starlight, the amount of starlight around, you would expect that kind of level of radiation at that temperature. But the Electric Universe points out that the signals that have been received recently, which show a polarization of the magnetic field, which follows a rotary pattern, it's quite a large pattern, and it is not explained except by the Big Bangers as some kind of effect caused by this incredible expansion phase right in the at the earliest 10 to the minus 36 or 10 to the minus 37 of a second. I mean, just even to suggest such a thing shows the incredible hubris of these people. Anyway, the Electric Universe has said for a long time that this radiation they're detecting is not from the edges of the universe, otherwise it would throw shadows. Objects nearby would throw shadows, and they don't see such shadows. But the other aspect is that the electric power that flows through galaxies takes the form of Birkeland currents, which have a rotary magnetic field, polarized magnetic field. And this seems to be exactly what these people have discovered. But of course, when all you have is a Big Bang as your as your model, everything has to be fitted to that. And of course, this is what happens.
Now, what about the Higgs boson? That was supposedly the thing that was going to prove how gravity works.
Well, it was supposed to show, or as an explanation for why matter has mass.
Right.
Well, that was one of the silliest ideas ever. And we've spent more than $13 billion chasing that rabbit down that hole. The reason is that if anyone cared to look at the equation that most people, or the equation most known by everyone, E equals mc squared, it's telling us simply that energy, mass, and the speed of light are all properties of matter. And therefore, mass is an intrinsic property of matter. It doesn't have to be imposed by some imaginary particle external to normal matter. I mean, it really is an incredible thing to suggest that matter doesn't have energy, because we know that when you split the atom, you know, there's plenty of energy.
Well, what do you think they found when they found the Higgs boson?
When you smash particles together with sufficient energy, you get short-lived resonant states of matter, which show up as this incredible zoo of short-lived particles. They have no real significance, except that you may be able to determine something about the substructure of particles. But since people are not looking in the right way at the debris and so on, they're not going to find the answer. You have to have the right model when you design an experiment, otherwise your interpretations go astray. And this is one of the big problems in physics at present. There's a lot of wonderful work being done by scientists, a lot of great experimental work and observational work, but it's all being destroyed by the theorists who are just playing mathematical games.
Now, when it comes to black holes, dark energy, dark matter, I noticed you, from reading Thunderbolts articles, one of your sites is thunderbolts.info.
Yes.
And that's where I first really started to learn about this stuff. And from reading the articles on there, when they had announced they found the biggest black hole ever discovered or whatever, my brain immediately was able to read the article and take it apart and realize that what they were trying to say and what they were actually discovering were two different things.
Yes.
And it was amazing to me that that's so easy for them to just put that information out there and make these giant assumptions and these giant leaps when all they were really finding were a couple of gamma rays and x-rays, I think, is the only thing they had actually discovered.
That's right. Yes, the problem that modern cosmology faces is that they see very concentrated outbursts of energetic radiation. And when all you have is the weakest force in the universe, gravity, to drive these outbursts, then you have to postulate incredible concentrations of matter, despite the fact there's no indication that you can actually compress matter to the extent that they require, and also that it uses a physics which treats matter in a way which is non-physical. In fact, we have one of our the members of our Thunderbolts team, Stephen Crothers, has shown that the mathematics behind black holes is flawed in about three or four different ways. And he has challenged the leading lights black hole theory to point out where he's wrong. And the arguments are so simple that you can actually state them in plain English and people can follow it. So I recommend having a look at Steve Crothers' work. He has suffered at the hands of academia as a result of doing this, so now he's sort of independent. He attended a lecture in Europe on black holes, where he was invited to speak, but when he spoke and pointed out all of the faults, he said no one would talk to him. And the funny thing is that all of the papers that followed continued the mistakes and ignored what he'd said as if he'd never spoken. And unfortunately, this is typical. You know, when you challenge a cherished belief, and they are beliefs, they're not real science, you get the same kind of treatment as anyone who challenges somebody's beliefs. But the black hole theory is nonsense from beginning to end. Where you have a concentration of mass, you have a concentration of energy. And the easiest way to get a concentration of energy has been shown by plasma scientists in the laboratory in what's known as a plasma focus, a dense plasma focus. And here you can concentrate all of the energy from a huge room full of capacitors into something which is a millimeter or so across, a tiny little donut. Now, this is what we have at the centers of galaxies, only it's not a few millimeters across, it might be the size of the solar system. But it's a concentration of relativistic particles, which obviously have tremendous mass in a small volume, but it's nothing like a black hole. And also, it has the tendency to become unstable and emit jets along the axis of the donut. So, and this is exactly what we see, of course. So the plasma cosmologists have a model which can explain what we see in deep space without recourse to all of these crazy and mathematically incorrect theories about concentrations of mass like neutron stars and black holes.
And one of the things about the electric universe theory is that you can replicate this stuff in a lab.
That's right.
So you can go on.
Yeah, one of the problems, of course, that astronomers have always complained about is that they can't replicate their gravitational models in the lab because gravity is so weak. However, plasma cosmologists have been able to perform experiments using the highest energy electric discharge equipment in the world, like at the Sandia laboratories, the Z-pinch machine. And you stand back a kilometer or two with X-ray telescopes to watch the experiment, and then cost you about $100,000 to repair the damage afterwards. The energy is so concentrated and so powerful. These are the kinds of things that we're looking at in deep space when we look at these concentrated bursts of X-rays and gamma rays.
Okay. When it comes to quasars, as you mentioned earlier, what do they have to do with galaxy formation?
Well, the so-called black hole, the little donut at the center of a galaxy, which occasionally becomes unstable and emits particles in beams, actually produces matter at close to the speed of light. And over time, Helton Arp found that it formed knots of matter, which then gradually gained in mass over time and slowed down, and their redshift decreased with time in steps, in quantum steps. And this gives you a clue that quantum phenomena are basically an electrical resonance phenomenon, which can actually operate on galactic scales. So there is no dichotomy between the galactic scale and the subatomic in the electric universe. All of this stuff comes together and becomes simple to understand. The quasars go on then to become themselves. They slow down and go into orbit about the main galaxy and become companion galaxies, or they become Seyfert galaxies and so on, which themselves give birth to other quasars. And so you have families, and you can actually determine the genealogy of galactic families. It paints an entirely different picture. It's almost a biological picture of our position in the scheme of things.
When When Einstein died, he had just, if I remember right, just given Velikovsky approval to do more research on the electrical properties of planets. And, of course, that went away with Einstein's death. What do you think would have happened had Einstein backed Velikovsky, you know, if he hadn't died?
Well, that's a good question. Yes, I've been told that story is true, Einstein was backing the test of radio noises from Jupiter because that was unexpected, and yet that was found to be the case, that Jupiter is the noisiest radio object in the sky apart from the Sun. This was unexpected because this was supposed to be just a gas giant floating around in space, minding its own business and not transmitting in the radio wavelengths. So if that experiment had gone ahead, I'm not sure that that would have been accepted, because it seems that when you make a really big challenge to science, the problem is that no evidence is sufficient to sway those who stand to lose credibility and even their status in the hierarchy by accepting this data. This has happened time and time again. I've seen it. There is no, investigative journalism in science. So scientists are more or less a law unto themselves. They're unaccountable, as much as any church. In fact, Halton Arp said that there are many similarities between the medieval church and modern institutionalized science. And this is a very sad state of affairs. Institutionalized science is designed to fail, because real breakthroughs always come from individuals, and individuals are crushed in the present scientific or the individuals who are making really big challenges get no hearing.
Okay. Someone might say, well, the Standard Model is so confirmed by modern science, but that's not necessarily the case, is it? They often make predictions and then have to change or add more mathematics and stuff to make those predictions work.
Yeah. The models are infinitely adjustable. We've got so many knobs to twiddle, you can match anything. I remember there was a cartoon once where it was suggested that if you twiddled a knob, changed one variable, then you could produce a koala bear. And it is almost like that now. And I think the fundamental problem is that we don't learn from history. In fact, I think the way science is taught has to change. We need to have more history and philosophy, and not the sanitized history that we're given to students these days, but the real debates that went on when big decisions were made, usually by a show of hands. And of course, science shouldn't be decided on a show of hands. It should be decided on the evidence. But many of the big decisions have been made almost on the basis of show business rather than any real strong evidence. We were talking about Einstein, actually, and before, and I don't think we've quite finished that one. I don't think Einstein was ready to discard his work, although he had been sidelined by his peers, because he had, you know, for most of his life, I mean, he produced some things early on which were given a showbiz welcome after the Great Wars, as they were called. And I think it was a case at that time, people were looking for an escape from reality. And we did it both in the arts and the sciences. You know, we had surrealism. Salvador Dali was inspired by Einstein and painted his melting watches and strange landscapes. And I would argue that both quantum theory and relativity were born out of this escape from realism, because Niels Bohr wasn't interested in explaining quantum theory, just to get equations that work. And this is still the state of quantum theory. It's like a recipe book with no understanding of why the recipe works. In Einstein's case, he tried to explain gravity in a way which cannot work. I mean, it doesn't explain what warp space is. Space isn't a thing, it's just a concept, so you can't warp a concept. And also, you could say that his idea of relativity itself was a case of making something which is apparent to the observer and saying that's actually real. It's like watching somebody disappearing in the distance on the back of a train or a ship or something. And as they disappear in the distance, they shrink in size, and if we could hear their watch ticking, it would appear to tick more slowly just by the Doppler effect. What Einstein did in effect was to say those things were real when we know they're not. And of course, as soon as he did that, it meant that we departed from real physics and any chance of understanding gravity or quantum mechanics. It's funny, just by doing that, he prevented quantum theory from having an explanation, because that requires instantaneous communication between separated matter, as seen in these so-called spooky action at a distance experiments, and this crazy word non-locality. All it means is instantaneous action at a distance. And Newton's law, of course, which, as I said earlier, is an instantaneous action at a distance theory, which Newton had the sense to say he didn't understand. But Einstein lost the plot and thought he'd explained it.
Now, when it comes to relativity, haven't they done experiments where they've shown that, like, clocks flying around the Earth come up at different times than the ones sitting stable on the Earth?
Yes, they're talking about clocks, not time. And you've got to make the distinction very carefully, because it's been found that subatomic effects on the Earth can be traced to activity on the sun, instantaneous activity on the sun, or the position of the sun with respect to the Earth or the moon. All of these things have been shown experimentally. So subatomic particles are subject to their location in space relative to everything else. So if you put a clock up in space above the Earth, then you have to adjust its rate of ticking, or at least allow for a change in its rate of ticking in the gravitational field. It's simply because the matter in the clock is now at a different distance from the matter in the Earth. But it has nothing to do with time. In the electric universe, there is a universal clock, if you like. There is universal time. And you cannot mess with it. You can't slow it down, speed it up. You can't time travel, which is unfortunate for the science fiction fans. but when you think about it, even the idea of an arrow of time is nonsense. The mathematicians often confuse the symbols with something that they make up. And that's the case with the arrow of time, because somebody once said, okay, if time has a direction, point me in the direction of time. You can't do it, because time is merely a concept of the intervals between two of, you know, separate events. And Einstein confused the issue by saying that the speed of light was the maximum speed with which he could tell whether an event was coincident in time between two separated incidents. And once he did that, of course, this messed things up more than somewhat. So one of the things that comes out of the electric universe is that you realize that when matter is connected in real time, obviously it can't be an infinite speed, because infinite means nothing. It means that on our scale, maybe within this entire galaxy, you can expect that all of the matter is in touch with all of the other matter. And when you think about it, you couldn't actually form a spiral galaxy if the stars on one side had to wait 100,000 years before they knew where the stars on the other side were. You could not maintain a beautiful spiral galaxy, the most common form of what I would call a galactic electric discharge in the universe.
Okay. the theory of dark matter and dark energy is one of the things that they have created in order to explain how galaxies hold together. Mm-hmm. But the electric universe theory explains that much in a much neater, simpler way, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes, there's a number of beliefs which have to be stifled. And I understand the difficulties in that, because when I came across these stumbling blocks, some of them took me a decade to let go of, you know, these beliefs about how what's real and what's not in science. The thing is that if you use Newton's law of gravity, and you look at the orbits of stars around the center of a galaxy, you find that it revolves more like a solid disk than it does the planets in our solar system, where the inner planets rotate around the sun at a rapid rate. They have very short years, and the ones in the outer solar system have years measured in decades on Earth. You'd expect the same would happen in the galaxies, but it doesn't. So it was decided that you could fix this and maintain Newton's law, provided you put a whole lot of mass, invisible mass, somewhere surrounding the galaxy in just the right places. But this is a completely ad hoc arrangement just to save your theory. That is, that Newton's law applies in galaxies. However, the plasma cosmologists have both experimentally and also in supercomputer simulations shown that the spiral shape of a galaxy and its rotation, even the fine detail in the rotation, is matched by an electromagnetic system where you have electric currents flowing along the arms of the spiral galaxy in towards the nucleus. And that, of course, also explains the super concentration of energy and mass at the center of the galaxy. So that doesn't require the invention of any mysterious dark matter. As for dark energy, this is a case where the expectations of the expanding universe weren't being met, and it appeared to be an accelerating expansion. So then some kind of anti-gravity had to be invented, which could speed up the process. But that was all based on the standard candles they call supernovae. Supernovae are supposed to explode in a predictable way, and you can measure their light output and the curve of the light to give you the distance when you know the brightness of the supernova. And they found that more distant supernovae seemed to be fainter than expected, which they interpreted as being further away than expected. And that meant that their theories of expansion had to be reinvestigated and rejigged. And as I said before, the problem with science today is that you're rewarded for inventing new forces and new particles, instead of being asked to simplify, reduce the number of particles and forces. So this is what happened. But of course, no one understands a supernova explosion. No one has been able to reproduce it theoretically. And the explanation that's given for a supernova explosion, that just doesn't work. But I published a paper in a peer-reviewed journal quite a few years ago now, and showing that it is simply another case where the electrical energy being fed into a galaxy also feeds the stars. And a supernova is like throwing a circuit breaker on one of those huge intercontinental transmission power lines. And you've probably seen the videos where if you throw the switch at the wrong time, this huge arc of electricity follows the switch all the way up and then... extends out into the atmosphere for some meters. If it's been shown in plasma physics that you can form what's called a double layer, which can act as a switch. It can actually switch the current off. And if it does that suddenly, it's just like the intercontinental power transmission line. All of the energy in that circuit is concentrated on that switch. And if there's a hapless star at the where the switch is, which is normal, that star cops all of the energy in its galactic circuit in a very short interval of time. And, of course, the star goes berserk. But so the electric universe has an explanation. It also says that the supernovae are fainter in high redshifted objects, galaxies, simply because high redshifted objects are young, they are less energetic, and therefore supernovae are less energetic. There's no necessity to postulate the universe is expanding at a faster rate and needs dark energy. So all of these things become very simple.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, I think, one of the things that impressed me so much is that it was so simple and it made so much sense.
Mm.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Wallace Thornhill.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, links section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
So we're talking tonight with Wallace Thornhill about the electric universe theory. Let's bring things a little closer to home. Let's get into plasma discharges that may have been seen here on Earth, and mythologies and stuff like that, and the work of Anthony Perrott as well, if you don't mind.
Yes.
Now, Anthony has shown that a lot of the something like 80 different forms of ancient art are actually symbols of plasma discharge. And Robert Schock, too, has pointed out that the Easter Island glyphs seem to be plasma discharges. And what does this mean? Why are all these plasma discharges showing up in ancient cultures?
Well, I think it's significant that to actually chisel in rock these petroglyphs, as they're called, is a considerable amount of work. It's not something you would do just to like doodling. And the very fact that Tony was able to find there's about 84 different forms of a plasma discharge. It goes through a series of stages, and they take quite striking forms. And one of the most striking and perhaps long-lived was what's called the squatter man, where you have the central discharge, and then you have a plasma disc comes out from the central discharge and then curls upwards. And there's one further along the axis which curls downwards. And there's one in the center which remains flat. Now, when looked at side on, plasma tends to be transparent, except where the energy is very high. So anyone looking at it side on would see what looked like a squatter man, somebody with their arms, their elbows out from their body and their arms raised up at right angles and their legs out at right angles also. But between their elbows and their knees on each side is this bright ring or dot. And you find this all around the world. And it is a classic form of a plasma discharge seen side on. But apart from that, Tony said that most of the other forms are also to be seen, except for a few which are related to a time when the plasma discharge is actually emitting lethal X-rays. So anyone standing out in the open chiseling on the rock would have been killed by the radiation.
Right.
And so he then found that these petroglyphs, he could actually predict where they would be found on a rock wall, because he said that they were looking at a part of the sky that was shielded by something on the horizon from the lethal X-rays. And also the X-rays, he said, tend to travel down canyons and that like a river. So you'd have to find a spot on the canyon wall where it was safe. But I think it also shows that whatever was happening, the ancient peoples, who we have no reason to believe they weren't as intelligent as we are, it was just that they were dealing with a situation that we would find absolutely horrific, the equivalent of doomsday, and they wanted to chisel their experiences for future generations, if there were to be any. And this answers all kinds of questions, because It's known that civilizations sprang up seemingly from nowhere, and it was after this event. They all looked back upon these events in the past. They were a memory, and they memorialized what was seen in the sky and in their architecture and their city layouts, that kind of thing. So it's interesting. You know, I'm able to walk into a museum and look at ancient figurines and carvings and pictures and so on, taken from cave walls and that, and I can see what they're trying to tell me. And I think this is of profound importance. We have to pay particular attention to what the most ancient races on Earth still have to tell us, like the North American Indians and their myths, creation myths, the Australian Aborigines and their creation myths about the rainbow serpent that changed the landscape. All of these things right around the world. And this is what Velikovsky began to do, and other scholars who picked up on it have been continuing to do, and they're members of the Thunderbolts.info group, of course.
Okay, and David Talbot has done a lot of work lining up the mythology as well with what may have actually happened in the past.
That's right, yes. He and Eduardo Cardona and F. Cochran in particular have done amazing scholarship to try and piece together what the ancients were desperate to have us understand, and which we've studiously misinterpreted for thousands of years. But the picture that is painted is one which is just amazing. It gives you a whole new feeling for what our forefathers, our ancient forebears went through, and why they did the things they did, what motivated them to build pyramids that we couldn't even build today, and did this all around the world, and obelisks and so on. It throws our history into a completely different light. It's not the kind of once upon a time fairy tale that we're taught. You begin to understand what all these strange anthropomorphic gods and things were that were worshipped around the world, and why there was this feeling that you know, the gods lived and fought and capriciously in the heavens. That's exactly where they were. And what these thunderbolts of the gods were, when you look at the carvings or the sculptures of Zeus and his thunderbolt, it's nothing like a modern lightning bolt, which looks like a spark. Zeus's thunderbolt has the form of a plasmoid, which is the form that you would expect a discharge to take place in space. So these are the kinds of things which give you pretty solid evidence that we have to take this work material, this mytho-historical record, as it's called, seriously, if we're to understand our forebears, our real history, and our past. Because Velikovsky, in his, I think, his final work, Mankind in Amnesia, felt that unless we understand our past, we will continue as a race to behave irrationally. And I mean, you've only got to look around for a moment to see just how irrational we are. The doomsday fear is unexplained unless you understand our real past. Our separateness, our desire to set up them and us, you know, at odds with each other, and then to have this cathartic visitation of doomsday on each other by trying to destroy one or the other of us in our crazy wars. All of this stuff, when you understand it, Velikovsky felt that unless we understand it, we may not have a future on this planet. And I tend to agree with him. We have to understand our past, come to terms with it, and grow up.
Well said. Now, part of the reason we didn't recognize what these symbols, these petroglyphs, were, is because until they were produced in the lab, we had never seen anything like it in modern times.
That's right. Yeah, Tony said when he came to our meetings and began to realize what he'd found, said that he went hunting around Los Alamos and he walked past the North American Indian petroglyphs and that without without even realizing. He hadn't stopped to think, you know, that there'd be any connection between them and the work he'd done in his laboratory. And yet he was the expert, the world expert, on these plasma instabilities, as they're called.
Let's look at Robert Schoch's theory,
mm-hmm.
That the sun had released such an outburst that it caused these plasma formations on Earth and ended the last ice age. Is that something that is realistic under the Electric Universe theory?
It's one of the things that has to be considered, because the discharges, of course, occur along the magnetic field line. So you'll tend to see stupendous auroras if there's any electrical disturbance close to the Earth. And Tony Pratt actually used that in his peer-reviewed papers discussing this discovery. But the mytho-historical record, if you can call it that, shows that that wasn't the case. It wasn't the sun at all that was involved, that it had something to do with a chaotic stage in the solar system where certain planets were very close to the Earth in an alignment which is completely at odds with Newtonian physics, but which does, I believe, have an explanation when you understand the electrical nature of gravity. That is one of the aspects of the electric universe. All forces collapse down to be explained simply as an electric force, which simplifies physics enormously and gives new understanding to quantum mechanics and to the mechanics of the universe itself.
Okay, when we look at Mars,
mm-hmm.
You guys have done some fantastic videos showing that you can recreate in the lab exactly the type of scarring we see on the surface of Mars.
Yes, that's right. In fact, this is one of the big tests, is to be able to reproduce in the laboratory the scarring that you see on planets and moons. Because these thunderbolts of Jupiter, if you like to call them that, although it wasn't Jupiter that was necessarily involved, are able to sculpt the surface of a planet in a very short period of time, measured in minutes and hours. That's why you can have some objects in the solar system with completely different scarring patterns on one face than the other. Our own moon is an example. But in Mars' case, it has one of the biggest gashes across its face in the solar system. The Valles Marineris is a colossal scar which stretches a third of the way around the planet and is up to 9 kilometers deep. I mean, it's hard to imagine. But the ancients actually have stories about Mars receiving that scar. Now, no astronomer on Earth imagines that Mars has a history which can be recounted in terms of a few thousand years ago, and also something as colossal as that scar on the face of Mars. But when you look at it from the electrical point of view, it just becomes obvious. In fact, one of the nice things about the electric universe is that it returns science to individuals who want to try things out in their garage or laboratory. And we have a number of garage experimenters who are producing detailed reproductions of in miniature of the things we see on the surface of Mars and other bodies.
Okay, what planet do you think caused the scarring?
Well, Mars was said to have been had a battle with Venus, the comet Venus. And I think that was the most likely where the thunderbolt came from. Venus itself has scars which stretch around the equator, but they're more filamentary, and that's the kind of thing that happens when you have a thick atmosphere. The lightning becomes not the plasma form that you see in space, but it becomes the lightning form you see in the Earth's atmosphere, you know, thin filamentary lightning bolts. And that's what you see on Venus, scars stretching around the equator. So Venus was certainly involved. The Earth was involved too, because Mars traveled between Venus and the Earth. At times it was regarded as a giant in the sky, the god of war, and at other times it was a baby returning to the womb of the mother goddess, Venus. The stories like this tell us all sorts of details about what went on, and you can reconstruct an incredible amount of what actually happened. But Mars was transferred both matter and electricity between Venus and the Earth. And the very fact that meteorites from Mars are still landing on the Earth today is significant, because these thunderbolts just rip material from the face of a planet and hurl it into space. Some of it may be trapped as a moon, and Mars has two small moons. Others become asteroids, cometary material, and meteors, which then become meteorites when they enter the Earth's atmosphere.
Now, do you think that the asteroid belt came about because of this collision?
Yes. The astronomer Tom Van Flanden pointed out that the orbits of the asteroids and comets as well suggests some event that occurred in the asteroid belt region. And he thought it was a single event, or it may have been maybe two events, something like that. But the result is that it stripped whatever it was. He thought it was the collision or the explosion of a planet, but he never explained how you explode a planet. The electric universe doesn't need to postulate that. It has eyewitnesses which described what happened to Mars, and it is obvious that it had material ripped off its surface, some of it kilometers deep. So that a lot of the debris out there is material excavated from Mars. And it should be very easy to test this once we begin landing on asteroids and taking samples and so on. And then the real history of the solar system will begin to be uncovered.
Well, do you think it really will, or do you think they'll come up with alternative explanations?
Well, I think eventually I have confidence that the truth will come out. And, I mean, when you stretch your theories with ad hoc additions and more barnacles, eventually the whole thing sinks, can no longer float. And I think that will happen. Also, I think people will begin to get sick of the science fiction type headlines and promises and that from science. It could be said that fundamental science hasn't progressed anywhere in the last century. You know, technology has progressed amazingly, but it can work without actually understanding things. It just needs proof in the laboratory that something can happen, and then you can utilize that in industry, perhaps, or some kind of new device. And this happens in quantum mechanics, of course, because our electronics relies on quantum theory. But quantum theory has no explanation. So technology advances even with the fundamentals of science doesn't.
And this is why we can put spaceships in orbit and stuff, because the formulas work, yeah. Even if we don't understand why they work.
Yes. We use Newton's law for navigating around the solar system, but no one understands it any more than Newton did.
So Velikovsky's idea that Venus was the one that slammed into Mars and did all the damage and stuff, do you think that's probably correct?
Well, yes, to a point, except that the planets don't slam into one another. When they get close enough, the thunderbolts themselves exchange energy, which then changes the mass of the planets, so their orbits gradually move into situations where they interact with each other the least. There is no explanation for why the solar system runs like clockwork, because Newton's theory suggests that the whole thing should be chaotic, but it's not. And also, Venus has the most circular orbit of any planet in the solar system after having been, according to our ancient forebears, a giant comet. The answer is simply that a comet is exchanging electric charge with the solar wind at a huge rate. And that's why you can't predict the return of a comet, because it has these so-called non-gravitational forces. Well, Venus is the most circular orbit because it's still discharging, but invisibly. But in the old days, it must have been a phenomenal sight.
I was pretty impressed with Laird Scranton's book on Velikovsky, where he took modern science and showed that none of it disproved Velikovsky, but a lot of it supported him.
That's true. Yes, in fact, Velikovsky didn't depart from the scientific method at all. What he did was he said, if we look at what the ancients were trying to tell us, we can, with our modern knowledge, figure out what that meant physically on Earth. And he did that and showed that it made sense, which indicated that the stories were not simply myths or legends or something that we could ignore. We had to take them into account and find explanations. And that was the start of, for me, in fact, when I visited him at his home just before he died, my question was, what don't we understand about gravity? And it was he who put me onto the idea of polarized matter, electrically polarized matter. And that sort of led on over many decades to where we are now with the electric universe model.
Now, if there had been life on Mars back in ancient times,
yes,
would there even be any remnants of it after a interaction with Venus?
That's a very good question. But I think since kilometers of material has been removed, particularly from the northern hemisphere, you won't find anything there. And I try and imagine what it would be like if the Earth had suffered the same fate and whether we'd actually find any trace of our civilizations. And I think it would be very difficult. You'd have to be extremely lucky.
How close did other planets come to the Earth, do you think?
David Talbot estimated from his work that Mars at one point was 40 times the diameter of the full moon.
Wow.
Which would be oppressive, to say the least.
Yeah. And what's the time frame in the past we're looking at for this?
Well, this is where we depart from Velikovsky, who brought it down into historical times, 1500 BC and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at the end of the last ice age, which is variously dated around 10 to 12,000 years ago. But there may have been, after those major events, there would have been a lot of settling down afterwards, and there must have been some colossal, spectacular comets and things like that, debris flying around, which must have scared our ancestors, even down into historical times. So there were echoes, I think, because every time these things happened, we still have that fear of comets. It's quite irrational because no one's ever witnessed anything happen as a result of a comet. And
right.
And the comets don't put on that greater display these days. But it's a hangover from our past. It's kind of a racial memory, like a bird freezing at the shadow of a hawk overhead. We tend to freeze at the sight of a comet.
So what was the configuration of the solar system, do you think, before the end of the last ice age?
We wouldn't, if we were transported back to before that time, we would not know where we were. We'd have no references like we have today.
There'd be that different. So, like, would we have the same planets?
No. One of the things about the electrical model of gravity is that capture of planets and moons is far more likely because you get electrical transfer of between the objects, and that modifies the orbits in such a way that capture is likely. And it seems that all of our gas giants in the outer solar system are captured because when we look at exoplanets around nearby stars, they have what are called hot Jupiters, these planets that are orbiting very rapidly around a central star, and they're very close to the central star. Those ones, I think, are probably due to electrical fissioning, so that you get multiple star systems of close orbiting bodies. Gas giants that are some distance away from the central star are the remnants of brown dwarfs, which were captured by the sun. Because a star is an electrical phenomenon. That's one of the other big hurdles that astrophysicists are going to have to face with our work, is that it seems that the power, the lightning bolts that form stars, also continue to power them invisibly with these Birkeland currents throughout their lives. And so if a faint star, a small star, comes close to a bright star, the bright star captures it and it switches off the small star because its power is no longer available. And astronomers know that there is what's called a brown dwarf desert around bright stars. The simple answer is that they're switched off when they come in and they become a gas giant. So all of the outer solar system giants were captured, and in the process they lost some of their moons, which became the planets in the inner solar system. And so everybody in the solar system has a unique story to tell. And some of them are family members and others are not. So there's a complicated story to untangle for future astronomers and those who visit the planets.
Okay. I've been wanting to ask you this one. Are you familiar with Walter Cruttenton?
I've heard the name, but I can't remember what he was responsible for.
Okay, he has a book called The Lost Star of Space, Lost Star of Myth and Time, or something like that, and he's pushing the binary star system, that we're in a binary star system. And one of the possibilities he suggests is that we're in a binary star system with Sirius. Now, would an electrical explanation connect us to Sirius? Like, because the argument is always that gravity isn't strong enough to hold Sirius and our sun together. They're too far away.
Yes.
Wouldn't it would.
Yes, that's right. It's Sirius is not a binary with us. It has its own partner, Sirius A and Sirius B. It's got nothing to do with us. The idea that there is there's a dark star ready to come in and create havoc is another manifestation of this doomsday fear. You know, something out there ready to get us. We would have discovered by now, I think, if there was a brown dwarf of any significance close to the solar system, because we've got these wonderful infrared telescopes in space, which have been able to detect very faint glowing objects at much greater distances than a binary partner for the sun would be expected to be found. So I don't think there is a binary partner out there. However, the story of the Earth is and its involvement in capture with a brown dwarf suggests that these encounters and the fact that we have more than one gas giant in our solar system suggests that these encounters do happen and can happen again. But let me tell you, if it does happen, we will have plenty of forewarning. because one of the things that the captured brown dwarf does is it turns into a phenomenal stellar-sized comet.
Now, when you talk about Brooklyn currents powering the stars, are these almost like invisible strings running through space?
Yes, they become visible in molecular clouds, and this is one area where the infrared telescopes have been valuable, because they've been able to pierce through the dust and the gloom and show that what you have in molecular clouds is like you have clouds on Earth, and that is lightning bolts. And the stars form along those lightning bolts, like beads on a string, it was said in one of the astronomy articles. Of course they're like beads on a string. It's almost a form of bead lightning. And the plasma cosmologists have described how stars are formed in those circumstances. And the important thing to note is that it preferentially puts all of the heavy elements at the center of the star, and the center of the star is the coolest material in the star. So there is no nuclear fusion going on in stars. So when you look through a sunspot and it's dark, it's because there's nothing going on underneath. I mean, this simple fact should have been obvious when we first looked at the sun, because if the energy is trying to escape from the sun and you have a hole in the photosphere, you expect it to be blindingly bright instead of dark. So this is another hurdle for astrophysicists in the near future.
Okay. You also had an explanation for the odd storm on Saturn's pole.
Mm-hmm. Yes. As I said earlier, the electric currents that flow to a planet, because a star is connected to a galactic circuit, the planets that orbit it are also kind of involved in that circuit, so they get some of the power. In the case of the gas giants, they get considerable power, and it flows in along the magnetic field lines to the poles. Now, there's very strange things going on, have been discovered at Saturn's pole. One is a hexagon, and another is a cyclonic circulation at the pole itself, and also the fact that the pole was found to be warm, although it had been in darkness for 14 years. I predicted that would be the case, because this is where energy is being fed down into the atmosphere of the planet. And the hexagonal pattern is one which forms when you get particle beams in the laboratory. Tends to form filaments, if you like. Instead of being a single beam, it breaks up and forms a number of beams, and it can be four or six. And six particle beams will form a hexagonal shape in the atmosphere of Saturn.
Okay. You think there's any chance that there's like a black project out there that's using these theories that we would never hear about?
I have no idea. it depends on the extent to which some scientists are willing to let go of what they believe and try things which are so-called on the fringe. In our case, I could see people reading, because I'm free with this stuff. I put it up on my website, holoscience.com. Could take this and run with it. And I've often felt that some small nation that has no attachment to the myths and legends of Western science could see the opportunities, because there are a lot of opportunities that open up in the realm of energy supplies, low-energy nuclear fusion, anti-gravity, all this kind of stuff can be investigated scientifically once you have a model to work on. You know, once you've got a model of how things work, you can then devise experiments and think up ways and means of utilizing it technologically.
It just occurred to me because, you know, I obviously the U.S. government has done work with remote viewing and things like that.
Yes.
That they say don't work, so why not take a theory like yours? And they didn't have to tell anyone they're using it.
Well, you begin to realize that, as I said earlier, the fundamental idea in the electric universe that all matter in the universe is connected, and it's connected electrically by the electric force, and matter which operates at the same, operates internally at the same subatomic frequencies, actually can communicate instantly, so you don't have this speed of light delay, and it raises the possibility of interstellar communication in real time. It also, you can understand how ESP can work, and also work in a Faraday cage, because it's just like gravity, you can't shield from it. The gravitational force is one aspect where the planets know where the stars are instantly. So in effect, ESP is like one person's mind being able to investigate something at a distance, because it's connected in a sense. It also explains why quantum experiments are so weird. It's because the observer is not separate from the experiment. They're all connected. So all of the spookiness and weirdness of quantum theory goes out the window and becomes understandable. Once you have an understanding, then the future of science is pretty rosy, because all kinds of possibilities open up. And in fact, it's a bit like Arthur C. Clarke said, any sufficiently advanced technology, which would have to be built on an advanced science, is indistinguishable from magic.
Yeah. All right. So if people want to find out more about your work, what's the best way they can do that?
Well, my website is called Holoscience, HOLOscience.com. And the reason for that is that it's a kind of holistic approach to science. It's a coherent big picture. The website which deals with the public far more is our thunderbolts.info website. And from there you can find out about our conferences, and you can get involved in discussions with others, and also you can get involved to any level you like. We have a lot of volunteers now who do sterling work in allowing us to present our material.
And you also publish a good deal of videos.
Yes, that's the other thing. Our conferences, we're getting more and more scholars coming along and finding that their work dovetails with ours, and their presentations are put up as YouTube videos following our conferences.
Okay.
I also have the Space News, which I do regularly, where I give my take on recent discoveries.
Okay, and you also have some DVDs out?
Yes. And they can be also found on that thunderbolts.info website.
And how many books do you have?
Well, the two major ones at present are The Electric Universe. Dave Talbot and I co-author our books. His work is more on the mytho-historical record, and mine is on the scientific. And the first book we put out, Thunderbolts of the Gods, deals with the record of the ancients and piecing that together in terms of the astronomy and also the plasma effects. The Electric Universe talks about the electrical nature of the universe. I have plans to put out another book, which I'm working on at present, which will give a kind of simple big picture story of the Earth and the Electric Universe.
When do you think that might be available?
Difficult to say. It depends on how many requests I get to either speak at conferences or do other things.
Okay. And do you have any conferences coming up?
Our big annual one was in March, so there are YouTube videos going up right now about that one. My next conference is the Nexus Conference here in Australia at the Sunshine Coast in August, first week of August. And that can be found also by a Google search.
Okay. All right. Well, I thank you so much, Walls. It's been fascinating talking to you, and I hope people check out your stuff, and there's so much detail on your sites that people who have further questions and want to delve into it deeper, you make it very easy for them to do it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, we're going to take you out with some Mechanism. This is Bring Back the Sun.
みんないつも時間に追われてる。誰も全てを見ようと。